successful general. Eudokia still attended his motions. At midnight, their tent was suddenly attacked by her angry brothers, impatient to expiate her infamy in his blood. His daring spirit refused her advice, and the disguise of a female habit. And boldly starting from his couch, he drew his sword and cut his way through the numerous assassins. It was here that he first betrayed his ingratitude and treachery. He engaged in a treasonable correspondence with the King of Hungary and the German Emperor, approached the royal tent at a suspicious hour with a drawn sword, and under the mask of a Latin soldier avowed an intention of revenge against a mortal foe, and imprudently praised the fleetness of his horse as an instrument of flight and safety. The monarch dissembled his suspicions, but after the close of the campaign, Andronicus was arrested and strictly confined in a tower of the palace of Constantinople. In this prison he was left about 12 years, a most painful restraint from which the thirst of action and pleasure perpetually urged him to escape. Alone and pensive, he perceived some broken bricks in a corner of the chamber and gradually widened the passage till he had explored a dark and forgotten recess. Into this hole he conveyed himself and the remains of his provisions, replacing the bricks in their former position and erasing with care the footsteps of his retreat. At the hour of the customary visit, his guards were amazed by the silence and solitude of the prison and reported with shame and fear his incomprehensible flight. The gates of the palace and city were instantly shut. The strictest orders were dispatched into the provinces for the recovery of the fugitive, and his wife, on the suspicion of a pious act, was basely imprisoned in the same tower. At the dead of night she beheld a spectre. She recognized her husband. They shared their provisions, and a son was the fruit of these stolen interviews, which alleviated the tediousness of their confinement. In the custody of a woman, the vigilance of the keepers was insensibly relaxed, and the captive had accomplished his real escape when he was discovered, brought back to Constantinople, and loaded with a double chain. At length he found the moment and the means of his deliverance. A boy, his domestic servant, intoxicated the guards and obtained, in wax, the impression of the keys. By the diligence of his friends, a similar key with a bundle of ropes was introduced into the prison in the bottom of a hogshead. Andronicus employed with industry and courage the instruments of his safety, unlocked the doors, descended from the tower, concealed himself all day among the bushes, and scaled in the night the garden wall of the palace. A boat was stationed for his reception. He visited his own house, embraced his children, cast away his chain, mounted a fleet horse, and directed his rapid course towards the banks of the Danube. At Anchialus, in Thrace, an intrepid friend supplied him with horses and money. He passed the river, traversed with speed the desert of Moldavia and the Carpathian hills, and had almost reached the town of Halys in the Polish Russia, when he was intercepted by a party of Wallachians, who resolved to convey their important captive to Constantinople. His presence of mind again extricated him from danger. Under the pretense of sickness, he dismounted in the night and was allowed to step aside from the troop. He planted in the ground his long staff, clothed it with his cap and upper garment, and stealing into the wood, left a phantom to amuse for some time the eyes of the Wallachians. From Halys he was honorably conducted to Kiev, the residence of the great duke. The subtle Greek soon obtained the esteem and confidence of Yaroslaus. His character could assume the manners of every climate, and the barbarians applauded his strength and courage in the chase of the elks and bears of the forest. In this northern region he deserved the forgiveness of Manuel, who solicited the Russian prince to join his arms in the invasion of Hungary. The influence of Andronicus achieved this important service. His private treaty was signed with a promise of fidelity on one side and of oblivion on the other, and he marched at the head of the Russian cavalry from the Borysthenes to the Danube. In his resentment, Manuel had ever sympathized with the martial and dissolute character of his cousin, and his free pardon was sealed in the assault of Zemlin, in which he was second, and second only, to the valor of the emperor. No sooner was the exile restored to freedom and his country than his ambition revived, at first to his own and at length to the public misfortune. The daughter of Manuel was a feeble bar to the succession of the more deserving males of the Comnenian blood. Her future marriage with the Prince of Hungary was repugnant to the hopes or prejudices of the princes and nobles. But when an oath of allegiance was required to the presumptive heir, Andronicus alone asserted the honour of the Roman name, declined the unlawful engagement, and boldly protested against the adoption of a stranger. His patriotism was offensive to the emperor, but he spoke the sentiments of the people, and was removed from the royal presence by an honourable banishment, a second command of the Cilician frontier, with the absolute disposal of the revenues of Cyprus. In this station, the Armenians again exercised his courage and exposed his negligence. And the same rebel who baffled all his operations was unhorsed and almost slain by the vigor of his lance. But Andronicus soon discovered a more easy and pleasing conquest. The beautiful Philippa, sister of the Empress Maria, and daughter of Raymond of Poitou, the Latin prince of Antioch. For her sake he deserted his station, and wasted the summer in balls and tournaments. To his love she sacrificed her innocence, her reputation, and the offer of an advantageous marriage. But the resentment of Manuel for this domestic affront interrupted his pleasures. Andronicus left the indiscreet princess to weep and to repent, and with a band of desperate adventurers undertook the pilgrimage of Jerusalem. His birth, his martial renown, and professions of zeal announced him as the champion of the cross. He soon captivated both the clergy and the king, and the Greek prince was invested with the lordship of Berytus on the coast of Phoenicia. In his neighborhood resided a young and handsome queen of his own nation and family, great-granddaughter of the Emperor Alexis, and widow of Baldwin III, King of Jerusalem. She visited and loved her kinsman. Theodora was the third victim of his amorous seduction, and her shame was more public and scandalous than that of her predecessors. The emperor still thirsted for revenge, and his subjects and allies of the Syrian frontier were repeatedly pressed to seize the person and put out the eyes of the fugitive. In Palestine he was no longer safe, but the tender Theodora revealed his danger and accompanied his flight. The Queen of Jerusalem was exposed to the East, his obsequious concubine, and two illegitimate children were the living monuments of her weakness. Damascus was his first refuge, and in the characters of the great Nur-ed-Din and his servant Saladin, the superstitious Greek might learn to revere the virtues of the Muslims. As the friend of Nur-ed-Din, he visited most probably Baghdad and the courts of Persia, and after a long circuit round the Caspian Sea and the mountains of Georgia, he finally settled among the Turks of Asia Minor, the hereditary enemies of his country. The Sultan of Colonia afforded a hospitable retreat to Andronicus, his mistress, and his band of outlaws. The debt of gratitude was paid by frequent inroads in the Roman province of Trebizond, and he seldom returned without an ample harvest of spoil and of Christian captives. In the story of his adventures, he was fond of comparing himself to David, who escaped by a long exile the snares of the wicked. But the royal prophet, he presumed to add, was content to lurk on the borders of Judea, to slay an Amalekite, and to threaten in his miserable state the life of the avaricious Nabal. The excursions of the Comnenian prince had a wider range, and he had spread over the eastern world the glory of his name and religion. By a sentence of the Greek Church, the licentious Rover had been separated from the faithful. But even this excommunication may prove that he never abjured the profession of Christianity. His vigilance had eluded or repelled the open and secret persecution of the emperor, but he was at length ensnared by the captivity of his female companion. The governor of Trebizond succeeded in his attempt to surprise the person of Theodora. The queen of Jerusalem and her two children were sent to Constantinople, and their loss embittered the tedious solitude of banishment. The fugitive implored and obtained a final pardon, with leave to throw himself at the feet of his sovereign, who was satisfied with the submission of this haughty spirit. Prostrate on the ground, he deplored with tears and groans the guilt of his past rebellion. Nor would he presume to arise unless some faithful subject would drag him to the foot of the throne by an iron chain with which he had secretly encircled his neck. This extraordinary penance excited the wonder and pity of the assembly. His sins were forgiven by the church and state, but the just suspicion of Manuel fixed his residence at a distance from the court at Inui, a town of Pontus, surrounded with rich vineyards and situated on the coast of the Black Sea. The death of Manuel and the disorders of the minority soon opened the fairest field to his ambition. The emperor was a boy of 12 or 14 years of age, without vigor or wisdom or experience. His mother, the Empress Mary, abandoned her person and government to a favorite of the Comnenian name, and his sister, another Mary, whose husband, an Italian, was decorated with the title of Caesar, excited a conspiracy, and at length an insurrection against her odious stepmother. The provinces were forgotten, the capital was in flames, and a century of peace and order was overthrown in the vice and weakness of a few months. A civil war was kindled in Constantinople. The two factions fought a bloody battle in the square of the palace, and the rebels sustained a regular siege in the cathedral of Santa Sophia. The patriarch labored with honest zeal to heal the wounds of the republic. The most respectable patriots called aloud for a guardian and avenger, and every tongue repeated the praise of the talents and even the virtues of Andronicus. In his retirement, he affected to revolve the solemn duties of his oath. If the safety of honor of the imperial family be threatened, I will reveal and oppose the mischief to the utmost of my power. His correspondence with the patriarch and patricians was seasoned with apt quotations from the Psalms of David and the epistles of St. Paul, and he patiently waited till he was called to her deliverance by the voice of his country. In his march from Inui to Constantinople, his slender train insensibly swelled to a crowd and an army. His professions of religion and loyalty were mistaken for the language of his heart, and the simplicity of a foreign dress, which showed to advantage his majestic stature, displayed a lively image of his poverty and exile. All opposition sunk before him. He reached the straits of the Thracian Bosphorus. The Byzantine navy sailed from the harbor to receive and transport the savior of the empire. The torrent was loud and irresistible, and the insects who had basked in the sunshine of royal favor disappeared at the blast of the storm. It was the first care of Andronicus to occupy the palace, to salute the emperor, to confine his mother, to punish her minister, and to restore the public order and tranquility. He then visited the sepulchre of Manuel. The spectators were ordered to stand aloof, but as he bowed in the attitude of prayer, they heard, or thought they heard, a murmur of triumph or revenge. I no longer fear thee, my old enemy, who hast driven me a vagabond to every climate of the earth. Thou art safely deposited under a sevenfold dome, from whence thou canst never arise till the signal of the last trumpet. It is now my turn, and speedily will I trample on thy ashes and thy posterity. From his subsequent tyranny we may impute such feelings to the man and the moment, but it is not extremely probable that he gave an articulate sound to his secret thoughts. In the first months of his administration, his designs were veiled by a fair semblance of hypocrisy, which could delude only the eyes of the multitude. The coronation of Alexius was performed with due solemnity, and his perfidious guardian, holding in his hands the body and blood of Christ, most fervently declared that he lived and was ready to die for the service of his beloved pupil. But his numerous adherents were instructed to maintain that the sinking empire must perish in the hands of a child, that the Romans could only be saved by a veteran prince, bold in arms, skillful in policy, and taught to reign by the long experience of fortune and mankind, and that it was the duty of every citizen to force the reluctant modesty of Andronicus to undertake the burden of the public care. The young emperor was himself constrained to join his voice to the general acclamation, and to solicit the association of a colleague who instantly degraded him from the supreme rank, secluded his person, and verified the rash declaration of the patriarch that Alexius might be considered as dead so soon as he was committed to the custody of his guardian. But his death was preceded by the imprisonment and execution of his mother. After blackening her reputation and inflaming against her the passions of the multitude, the tyrant accused and tried the empress for a treasonable correspondence with the king of Hungary. His own son, a youth of honor and humanity, avowed his abhorrence of this flagitious act, and three of the judges had the merit of preferring their conscience to their safety. But the obsequious tribunal, without requiring any reproof or hearing any defense, condemned the widow of Manuel, and her unfortunate son subscribed the sentence of her death. Maria was strangled, her corpse was buried in the sea, and her memory was wounded by the insult most offensive to female vanity, a false and ugly representation of her beauteous form. The fate of her son was not long deferred. He was strangled with a bowstring. Then the tyrant, insensible to pity or remorse, after surveying the body of the innocent youth, struck it rudely with his foot. "Thy father," he cried, "was a knave, thy mother a whore, and thyself a fool." The Roman scepter, the reward of his crimes, was held by Andronicus about 3 years and a half as the guardian or sovereign of the empire. His government exhibited a singular contrast of vice and virtue. When he listened to his passions, he was the scourge. When he consulted his reason, the father of his people. In the exercise of private justice, he was equitable and rigorous. A shameful and pernicious venality was abolished, and the offices were filled with the most deserving candidates by a prince who had sense to choose and severity to punish. He prohibited the inhuman practice of pillaging the goods and persons of shipwrecked mariners. The provinces, so long the objects of oppression or neglect, revived in prosperity and plenty, and millions applauded the distant blessings of his reign, while he was cursed by the witnesses of his daily cruelties. The ancient proverb that bloodthirsty is the man who returns from banishment to power had been applied with too much truth to Marius and Tiberius, and was now verified for the third time in the life of Andronicus. His memory was stored with a black list of the enemies and rivals who had traduced his merit, opposed his greatness, or insulted his misfortunes, and the only comfort of his exile was the sacred hope and promise of revenge. The necessary extinction of the young emperor and his mother imposed the fatal obligation of extirpating the friends who hated and might punish the assassin, and the repetition of murder rendered him less willing and less able to forgive. A horrid narrative of the victims whom he sacrificed by poison or the sword, by the sea or the flames, would be less expressive of his cruelty than the appellation of the halcyon days, which was applied to a rare and bloodless week of repose. The tyrant strove to transfer, on the laws and the judges, some portion of his guilt, but the mask was fallen, and his subjects could no longer mistake the true author of their calamities. The noblest of the Greeks, more especially those who by descent or alliance might dispute the Comnenian inheritance, escaped from the monster's den. Nice and Prusa, Sicily or Cyprus, were their places of refuge. And as their flight was already criminal, they aggravated their offence by an open revolt and the imperial title. Yet Andronicus resisted the daggers and swords of his most formidable enemies. Nice and Prusa were reduced and chastised. The Sicilians were content with the sack of Thessalonica, and the distance of Cyprus was not more propitious to the rebel than to the tyrant. His throne was subverted by a rival without merit, and a people without arms. Isaac Angelus, a descendant in the female line from the great Alexius, was marked as a victim by the prudence or superstition of the emperor. In a moment of despair, Angelus defended his life and liberty, slew the executioner, and fled to the church of Santa Sophia. The sanctuary was insensibly filled with a curious and mournful crowd who, in his fate, prognosticated their own. But their lamentations were soon turned to curses, and their curses to threats. They dared to ask, "Why do we fear? Why do we obey? We are many, and he is one. Our patience is the only bond of our slavery." With the dawn of day, the city burst into a general sedition. The prisons were thrown open. The coldest and most servile were roused to the defense of their country, and Isaac, the second of the name, was raised from the sanctuary to the throne. Unconscious of his danger, the tyrant was absent, withdrawn from the toils of state in the delicious islands of the Propontis. He had contracted an indecent marriage with Alice, or Agnes, daughter of Louis the Seventh of France, and relict of the unfortunate Alexius. And his society, more suitable to his temper than to his age, was composed of a young wife and a favorite concubine. On the first alarm, he rushed to Constantinople, impatient for the blood of the guilty. But he was astonished by the silence of the palace, the tumult of the city, and the general desertion of mankind. Andronicus proclaimed a free pardon to his subjects. They neither desired nor would grant forgiveness. He offered to resign the crown to his son Manuel, but the virtues of the son could not expiate his father's crimes. The sea was still open for his retreat, but the news of the revolution had flown along the coast. When fear had ceased, obedience was no more. The imperial galley was pursued and taken by an armed brigantine, and the tyrant was dragged to the presence of Isaac Angelus, loaded with fetters and a long chain round his neck. His eloquence and the tears of his female companions pleaded in vain for his life, but instead of the decencies of a legal execution, the new monarch abandoned the criminal to the numerous sufferers whom he had deprived of a father, a husband, or a friend. His teeth and hair, an eye and a hand, were torn from him as a poor compensation for their loss, and a short respite was allowed that he might feel the bitterness of death. Astride a camel, without any danger of a rescue, he was carried through the city, and the basest of the populace rejoiced to trample on the fallen majesty of their prince. After 1,000 blows and outrages, Andronicus was hung by the feet between two pillars that supported the statues of a wolf and a sow, and every hand that could reach the public enemy inflicted on his body some mark of ingenious or brutal cruelty, till two friendly or furious Italians, plunging their swords into his body, released him from all human punishment. In this long and painful agony, "Lord, have mercy upon me," and "Why will you bruise a broken reed?" were the only words that escaped from his mouth. Our hatred for the tyrant is lost in pity for the man. Nor can we blame his pusillanimous resignation, since a Greek Christian was no longer master of his life. I have been tempted to expatiate on the extraordinary character and adventures of Andronicus, but I shall here terminate the series of the Greek emperors since the time of Heraclius. The branches that sprang from the Comnenian trunk had insensibly withered, and the male line was continued only in the posterity of Andronicus himself, who, in the public confusion, usurped the sovereignty of Trebizond, so obscure in history and so famous in romance. A private citizen of Philadelphia, Constantine Angelus, had emerged to wealth and honors by his marriage with a daughter of the Emperor Alexius. His son Andronicus is conspicuous only by his cowardice. His grandson Isaac punished and succeeded the tyrant, but he was dethroned by his own vices and the ambition of his brother, and their discord introduced the Latins to the conquest of Constantinople, the first great period in the fall of the Eastern Empire. If we compute the number and duration of the reigns, it will be found that a period of 600 years is filled by 60 emperors, including in the Augustan list some female sovereigns, then deducting some usurpers who were never acknowledged in the capital, and some princes who did not live to possess their inheritance. The average proportion will allow 10 years for each emperor, far below the chronological rule of Sir Isaac Newton, who, from the experience of more recent and regular monarchies, has defined about 18 or 20 years as the term of an ordinary reign. The Byzantine Empire was most tranquil and prosperous when it could acquiesce in hereditary succession. 5 dynasties, the Heraclian, Isaurian, Amorian, Basilian, and Comnenian families, enjoyed and transmitted the royal patrimony during their respective series of 5, 4, 3, 6, and 4 generations. Several princes number the years of their reign with those of their infancy, and Constantine the 7th and his 2 grandsons occupy the space of an entire century. But in the intervals of the Byzantine dynasties, the succession is rapid and broken, and the name of a successful candidate is speedily erased by a more fortunate competitor. Many were the paths that led to the summit of royalty. The fabric of rebellion was overthrown by the stroke of conspiracy, or undermined by the silent arts of intrigue. The favorites of the soldiers or people, of the senate or clergy, of the women and eunuchs, were alternately clothed with the purple. The means of their elevation were base, and their end was often contemptible or tragic. A being of the nature of man, endowed with the same faculties, but with a longer measure of existence, would cast down a smile of pity and contempt on the crimes and follies of human ambition, so eager in a narrow span to grasp at a precarious and short-lived enjoyment. It is thus that the experience of history exalts and enlarges the horizon of our intellectual view. In a composition of some days, in a perusal of some hours, 600 years have rolled away, and the duration of a life or reign is contracted to a fleeting moment. The grave is ever beside the throne. The success of a criminal is almost instantly followed by the loss of his prize, and our immortal reason survives and disdains the 60 phantoms of kings who have passed before our eyes and faintly dwell on our remembrance. The observation that in every age and climate ambition has prevailed with the same commanding energy may abate the surprise of a philosopher, but while he condemns the vanity, he may search the motive of this universal desire to obtain and hold the scepter of dominion. To the greater part of the Byzantine series, we cannot reasonably ascribe the love of fame and of mankind. The virtue alone of John Comnenus was beneficent and pure. The most illustrious of the princes who precede or follow that respectable name have trod with some dexterity and vigor the crooked and bloody paths of a selfish policy. In scrutinizing the imperfect characters of Leo the Isaurian, Basil the First, and Alexius Comnenus, of Theophilus, the second Basil, and Manuel Comnenus, our esteem and censure are almost equally balanced, and the remainder of the imperial crown could only desire and expect to be forgotten by posterity. Was personal happiness the aim and object of their ambition? I shall not descant on the vulgar topics of the misery of kings, but I may surely observe that their condition, of all others, is the most pregnant with fear and the least susceptible of hope. For these opposite passions, a larger scope was allowed in the revolutions of antiquity than in the smooth and solid temper of the modern world, which cannot easily repeat either the triumph of Alexander or the fall of Darius. But the peculiar infelicity of the Byzantine princes exposed them to domestic perils without affording any lively promise of foreign conquest. From the pinnacle of greatness, Andronicus was precipitated by a death more cruel and shameful than that of the malefactor. But the most glorious of his predecessors had much more to dread from their subjects than to hope from their enemies. The army was licentious without spirit, the nation turbulent without freedom. The barbarians of the east and west pressed on the monarchy, and the loss of the provinces was terminated by the final servitude of the capital. The entire series of Roman emperors, from the first of the Caesars to the last of the Constantines, extends above 1,500 years, and the term of dominion, unbroken by foreign conquest, surpasses the measure of the ancient monarchies, the Assyrians or Medes, the successors of Cyrus, or those of Alexander. Chapter 49. Conquest of Italy by the Franks. Introduction, worship, and persecution of images. Revolt of Italy and Rome. Temporal dominion of the popes. Conquest of Italy by the Franks. Establishment of images. Character and coronation of Charlemagne. Restoration and decay of the Roman Empire in the West. Independence of Italy. Constitution of the Germanic body. In the connection of the church and state, I have considered the former as subservient only and relative to the latter. A salutary maxim, if in fact as well as in narrative, it had ever been held sacred. The Oriental philosophy of the Gnostics, the dark abyss of predestination and grace, and the strange transformation of the Eucharist from the sign to the substance of Christ's body, I have purposely abandoned to the curiosity of speculative divines. But I have reviewed with diligence and pleasure the objects of ecclesiastical history, by which the decline and fall of the Roman Empire were materially affected, the propagation of Christianity, the constitution of the Catholic Church, the ruin of paganism, and the sects that arose from the mysterious controversies concerning the Trinity and Incarnation. At the head of this class, we may justly rank the worship of images, so fiercely disputed in the 8th and 9th centuries, since a question of popular superstition produced the revolt of Italy, the temporal power of the popes, and the restoration of the Roman Empire in the West. The primitive Christians were possessed with an unconquerable repugnance to the use and abuse of images, and this aversion may be ascribed to their descent from the Jews and their enmity to the Greeks. The Mosaic law had severely prescribed all representations of the deity, and that precept was firmly established in the principles and practice of the chosen people. The wit of the Christian apologists was pointed against the foolish idolaters, who bowed before the workmanship of their own hands, the images of brass and marble which, had they been endowed with sense and motion, should have started rather from the pedestal to adore the creative powers of the artist. Perhaps some recent and imperfect converts of the Gnostic tribe might crown the statues of Christ and Saint Paul with the profane honors which they paid to those of Aristotle and Pythagoras. But the public religion of the Catholics was uniformly simple and spiritual, and the first notice of the use of pictures is in the censure of the Council of Illiberis, 300 years after the Christian era. Under the successors of Constantine, in the peace and luxury of the triumphant church, the more prudent bishops condescended to indulge a visible superstition for the benefit of the multitude. And after the ruin of paganism, they were no longer restrained by the apprehension of an odious parallel. The first introduction of a symbolic worship was in the veneration of the cross and of relics. The saints and martyrs whose intercession was implored were seated on the right hand of God. But the gracious and often supernatural favors, which in the popular belief were showered round their tomb, conveyed an unquestionable sanction of the devout pilgrims who visited and touched and kissed these lifeless remains, the memorials of their merits and sufferings. But a memorial, more interesting than the skull or the sandals of a departed worthy, is the faithful copy of his person and features, delineated by the arts of painting or sculpture. In every age, such copies, so congenial to human feelings, have been cherished by the zeal of private friendship or public esteem. The images of the Roman emperors were adored with civil and almost religious honors. A reverence less ostentatious but more sincere was applied to the statues of sages and patriots. And these profane virtues, these splendid sins, disappeared in the presence of the holy men who had died for their celestial and everlasting country. At first the experiment was made with caution and scruple, and the venerable pictures were discreetly allowed to instruct the ignorant, to awaken the cold, and to gratify the prejudices of the heathen proselytes. By slow, though inevitable progression, the honors of the original were transferred to the copy. The devout Christian prayed before the image of a saint, and the pagan rites of genuflection, luminaries, and incense again stole into the Catholic Church. The scruples of reason or piety were silenced by the strong evidence of visions and miracles, and the pictures which speak and move and bleed must be endowed with a divine energy and may be considered as the proper objects of religious adoration. The most audacious pencil might tremble in the rash attempt of defining by forms and colors the infinite spirit, the eternal Father who pervades and sustains the universe. But the superstitious mind was more easily reconciled to paint and to worship the angels, and above all the Son of God, under the human shape which on earth they have condescended to assume. The second person of the Trinity had been clothed with a real and mortal body, but that body had ascended into heaven, and had not some similitude been presented to the eyes of his disciples, the spiritual worship of Christ might have been obliterated by the visible relics and representations of the saints. A similar indulgence was requisite and propitious for the Virgin Mary. The place of her burial was unknown, and the assumption of her soul and body into heaven was adopted by the credulity of the Greeks and Latins. The use and even the worship of images was firmly established before the end of the 6th century. They were fondly cherished by the warm imagination of the Greeks and Asiatics. The Pantheon and Vatican were adorned with the emblems of a new superstition, but this semblance of idolatry was more coldly entertained by the rude barbarians and the Aryan clergy of the West. The bolder forms of sculpture in brass or marble, which peopled the temples of antiquity, were offensive to the fancy or conscience of the Christian Greeks, and a smooth surface of colors has ever been esteemed a more decent and harmless mode of imitation. The merit and effect of a copy depends on its resemblance with the original. But the primitive Christians were ignorant of the genuine features of the Son of God, his mother, and his apostles. The statue of Christ at Peneus in Palestine was more probably that of some temporal savior. The Gnostics and their profane monuments were reprobated, and the fancy of the Christian artists could only be guided by the clandestine imitation of some heathen model. In this distress, a bold and dexterous invention assured at once the likeness of the image and the innocence of the worship. A new superstructure of fable was raised on the popular basis of a Syrian legend, on the correspondence of Christ and Abgarus, so famous in the days of Eusebius, so reluctantly deserted by our modern advocates. The Bishop of Caesarea records the epistle, but he most strangely forgets the picture of Christ. The perfect impression of his face on a linen with which he gratified the faith of the royal stranger who had invoked his healing power and offered the strong city of Edessa to protect him against the malice of the Jews. The ignorance of the primitive church is explained by the long imprisonment of the image in a niche of the wall, from whence, after an oblivion of 500 years, it was released by some prudent bishop and seasonably presented to the devotion of the times. Its first and most glorious exploit was the deliverance of the city from the arms of Chosroes Nushirvan, and it was soon revered as a pledge of the divine promise that Edessa should never be taken by a foreign enemy. It is true, indeed, that the text of Procopius ascribes the double deliverance of Edessa to the wealth and valor of her citizens, who purchased the absence and repelled the assaults of the Persian monarch. He was ignorant, the profane historian, of the testimony which he is compelled to deliver in the ecclesiastical page of Evagrius, that the palladium was exposed on the rampart, and that the water which had been sprinkled on the holy face, instead of quenching, added new fuel to the flames of the besieged. After this important service, the image of Edessa was preserved with respect and gratitude. And if the Armenians rejected the legend, the more credulous Greeks adored the similitude which was not the work of any mortal pencil, but the immediate creation of the divine original. The style and sentiments of a Byzantine hymn will declare how far their worship was removed from the grossest idolatry. How can we, with mortal eyes, contemplate this image, whose celestial splendor the host of heaven presumes not to behold? He who dwells in heaven condescends this day to visit us by his venerable image. He who is seated on the cherubim visits us this day by a picture, which the Father has delineated with his immaculate hand, which he has formed in an ineffable manner, and which we sanctify by adoring it with fear and love. Before the end of the 6th century, these images, made without hands, in Greek it is a single word, were propagated in the camps and cities of the Eastern Empire. They were the objects of worship, and the instruments of miracles, and in the hour of danger or tumult, their venerable presence could revive the hope, rekindle the courage, or repress the fury of the Roman legions. Of these pictures, the far greater part, the transcripts of a human pencil, could only pretend to a secondary likeness and improper title. But there were some of higher descent, who derived their resemblance from an immediate contact with the original, endowed for that purpose with a miraculous and prolific virtue. The most ambitious aspired from a filial to a fraternal relation with the image of Edessa, and such is the Veronica of Rome, or Spain, or Jerusalem, which Christ in his agony and bloody sweat applied to his face and delivered to a holy matron. The fruitful precedent was speedily transferred to the Virgin Mary and the saints and martyrs. In the church of Diospolis in Palestine, the features of the Mother of God were deeply inscribed in a marble column. The east and west have been decorated by the pencil of St. Luke, and the evangelist, who was perhaps a physician, has been forced to exercise the occupation of a painter, so profane and odious in the eyes of the primitive Christians. The Olympian Jove, created by the muse of Homer and the chisel of Phidias, might inspire a philosophic mind with momentary devotion. But these Catholic images were faintly and flatly delineated by monkish artists in the last degeneracy of taste and genius. The worship of images had stolen into the church by insensible degrees, and each petty step was pleasing to the superstitious mind as productive of comfort and innocent of sin. But in the beginning of the 8th century, in the full magnitude of the abuse, the more timorous Greeks were awakened by an apprehension that under the mask of Christianity they had restored the religion of their fathers. They heard with grief and impatience the name of idolaters, the incessant charge of the Jews and Mohammedans, who derived from the law and the Quran an immortal hatred to graven images and all relative worship. The servitude of the Jews might curb their zeal and depreciate their authority, but the triumphant Muslims who reigned at Damascus and threatened Constantinople cast into the scale of reproach the accumulated weight of truth and victory. The cities of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt had been fortified with the images of Christ, his mother, and his saints, and each city presumed on the hope or promise of miraculous defense. In a rapid conquest of 10 years, the Arabs subdued those cities and these images, and in their opinion the Lord of Hosts pronounced a decisive judgment between the adoration and contempt of these mute and inanimate idols. For a while Edessa had braved the Persian assaults, but the chosen city, the spouse of Christ, was involved in the common ruin, and his divine resemblance became the slave and trophy of the infidels. After a servitude of 300 years, the Palladium was yielded to the devotion of Constantinople for a ransom of £12,000 of silver, the redemption of 200 Muslims, and a perpetual truce for the territory of Edessa. In this season of distress and dismay, the eloquence of the monks was exercised in the defense of images, and they attempted to prove that the sin and schism of the greatest part of the Orientals had forfeited the favor and annihilated the virtue of these precious symbols. But they were now opposed by the murmurs of many simple or rational Christians who appealed to the evidence of texts, of facts, and of the primitive times, and secretly desire the reformation of the church. As the worship of images had never been established by any general or positive law, its progress in the Eastern Empire had been retarded or accelerated by the differences of men and manners, the local degrees of refinement, and the personal characters of the bishops. The splendid devotion was fondly cherished by the levity of the capital and the inventive genius of the Byzantine clergy, while the rude and remote districts of Asia were strangers to this innovation of sacred luxury. Many large congregations of Gnostics and Arians maintained, after their conversion, the simple worship which had preceded their separation, and the Armenians, the most warlike subjects of Rome, were not reconciled in the 12th century to the sight of images. These various denominations of men afforded a fund of prejudice and aversion, of small account in the villages of Anatolia or Thrace, but which in the fortune of a soldier, a prelate, or a eunuch, might be often connected with the powers of the church and state. Of such adventurers, the most fortunate was the Emperor Leo III, who, from the mountains of Isauria, ascended the throne of the East. He was ignorant of sacred and profane letters, but his education, his reason, perhaps his intercourse with the Jews and Arabs, had inspired the martial peasant with a hatred of images, and it was held to be the duty of a prince to impose on his subjects the dictates of his own conscience. but in the outset of an unsettled reign, during 10 years of toil and danger, Leo submitted to the meanness of hypocrisy, bowed before the idols which he despised, and satisfied the Roman pontiff with the annual professions of his orthodoxy and zeal. In the reformation of religion, his first steps were moderate and cautious. He assembled a great council of senators and bishops, and enacted with their consent that all the images should be removed from the sanctuary and altar to a proper height in the churches, where they might be visible to the eyes and inaccessible to the superstition of the people. But it was impossible on either side to check the rapid, though adverse, impulse of veneration and abhorrence. In their lofty position, the sacred images still edified their votaries and reproached the tyrant. He was himself provoked by resistance and invective, and his own party accused him of an imperfect discharge of his duty, and urged for his imitation the example of the Jewish king who had broken without scruple the brazen serpent of the temple. By a second edict, he prescribed the existence as well as the use of religious pictures. The churches of Constantinople and the provinces were cleansed from idolatry. The images of Christ, the Virgin, and the saints were demolished, or a smooth surface of plaster was spread over the walls of the edifice. The sect of the iconoclasts was supported by the zeal and despotism of 6 emperors, and the East and West were involved in a noisy conflict of 120 years. It was the design of Leo the Isaurian to pronounce the condemnation of images as an article of faith, and by the authority of a general council. But the convocation of such an assembly was reserved for his son Constantine, and though it is stigmatized by triumphant bigotry as a meeting of fools and atheists, their own partial and mutilated acts betray many symptoms of reason and piety. The debates and decrees of many provincial synods introduced the summons of the general council, which met in the suburbs of Constantinople, and was composed of the respectable number of 338 bishops of Europe and Anatolia. For the patriarchs of Antioch and Alexandria were the slaves of the caliph, and the Roman pontiff had withdrawn the churches of Italy and the West from the communion of the Greeks. This Byzantine synod assumed the rank and powers of the 7th General Council. Yet even this title was a recognition of the 6 preceding assemblies which had laboriously built the structure of the Catholic faith. After a serious deliberation of 6 months, the 338 bishops pronounced and subscribed a unanimous decree that all visible symbols of Christ, except in the Eucharist, were either blasphemous or heretical, that image worship was a corruption of Christianity and a renewal of paganism, that all such monuments of idolatry should be broken or erased, and that those who should refuse to deliver the objects of their private superstition were guilty of disobedience to the authority of the church and of the emperor. In their loud and loyal acclamations, they celebrated the merits of their temporal redeemer, and to his zeal and justice they entrusted the execution of their spiritual censures. At Constantinople, as in the former councils, the will of the prince was the rule of episcopal faith. But on this occasion I am inclined to suspect that a large majority of the prelates sacrificed their secret conscience to the temptations of hope and fear. In the long night of superstition, the Christians had wandered far away from the simplicity of the gospel. Nor was it easy for them to discern the clue and tread back the mazes of the labyrinth. The worship of images was inseparably blended, at least to a pious fancy, with the cross, the Virgin, the saints, and their relics. The holy ground was involved in a cloud of miracles and visions, and the nerves of the mind, curiosity and skepticism, were benumbed by the habits of obedience and belief. Constantine himself is accused of indulging a royal license to doubt, or deny, or deride the mysteries of the Catholics. But they were deeply inscribed in the public and private creed of his bishops, and the boldest iconoclast might assault with a secret horror the monuments of popular devotion which were consecrated to the honor of his celestial patrons. In the Reformation of the 16th century, freedom and knowledge had expanded all the faculties of man. The thirst of innovation superseded the reverence of antiquity, and the vigor of Europe could disdain those phantoms which terrified the sickly and servile weakness of the Greeks. The scandal of an abstract heresy can be only proclaimed to the people by the blast of the ecclesiastical trumpet. But the most ignorant can perceive, the most torpid must feel, the profanation and downfall of their visible deities. The first hostilities of Leo were directed against a lofty Christ on the vestibule and above the gate of the palace. A ladder had been planted for the assault, but it was furiously shaken by a crowd of zealots and women. They beheld, with pious transport, the ministers of sacrilege tumbling from on high and dashed against the pavement. The honors of the ancient martyrs were prostituted to these criminals who justly suffered for murder and rebellion. The execution of the imperial edicts was resisted by frequent tumults in Constantinople and the provinces. The person of Leo was endangered, his officers were massacred, and the popular enthusiasm was quelled by the strongest efforts of the civil and military power. Of the archipelago, or Holy See, the numerous islands were filled with images and monks. Their votaries abjured without scruple the enemy of Christ, his mother, and the saints. They armed a fleet of boats and galleys, displayed their consecrated banners, and boldly steered for the harbor of Constantinople to place on the throne a new favorite of God and the people. They depended on the succor of a miracle, but their miracles were inefficient against the Greek fire, and after the defeat and conflagration of the fleet, the naked islands were abandoned to the clemency or justice of the conqueror. The son of Leo, in the first year of his reign, had undertaken an expedition against the Saracens. During his absence, the capital, the palace, and the purple were occupied by his kinsman Artavasdes, the ambitious champion of the Orthodox faith. The worship of images was triumphantly restored. The patriarch renounced his dissimulation, or dissembled his sentiments, and the righteous claims of the usurper was acknowledged, both in the new and in ancient Rome. Constantine flew for refuge to his paternal mountains, but he descended at the head of the bold and affectionate Isaurians, and his final victory confounded the arms and predictions of the fanatics. His long reign was distracted with clamor, sedition, conspiracy, and mutual hatred, and sanguinary revenge. The persecution of images was the motive or pretense of his adversaries, and if they missed a temporal diadem, they were rewarded by the Greeks with the crown of martyrdom. In every act of open and clandestine treason, the emperor felt the unforgiving enmity of the monks, the faithful slaves of the superstition to which they owed their riches and influence. They prayed, they preached, they absolved, they inflamed, they conspired. The solitude of Palestine poured forth a torrent of invective, and the pen of St. John Damascenus, the last of the Greek fathers, devoted the tyrant's head both in this world and the next. I am not at leisure to examine how far the monks provoked, nor how much they have exaggerated their real and pretended sufferings, nor how many lost their lives or limbs, their eyes or their beards, by the cruelty of the emperor. From the chastisement of individuals he proceeded to the abolition of the order, and as it was wealthy and useless, his resentment might be stimulated by avarice and justified by patriotism. The formidable name and mission of the dragon, his visitor general, excited the terror and abhorrence of the black nation. The religious communities were dissolved, the buildings were converted into magazines or bar racks, The lands, movables, and cattle were confiscated, and our modern precedents will support the charge that much wanton or malicious havoc was exercised against the relics and even the books of the monasteries. With the habit and profession of monks, the public and private worship of images was rigorously prescribed, and it should seem that a solemn abjuration of idolatry was exacted from the subjects, or at least from the clergy, of the Eastern Empire. The patient East abjured with reluctance her sacred images. They were fondly cherished and vigorously defended by the independent zeal of the Italians. In ecclesiastical rank and jurisdiction, the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Pope of Rome were nearly equal, but the Greek prelate was a domestic slave under the eye of his master, at whose nod he alternately passed from the convent to the throne, and from the throne to the convent. A distant and dangerous station amidst the barbarians of the West excited the spirit and freedom of the Latin bishops. Their popular election endeared them to the Romans. The public and private indulgence was relieved by their ample revenue, and the weakness or neglect of the emperors compelled them to consult, both in peace and war, the temporal safety of the city. In the school of adversity, the priest insensibly imbibed the virtues and the ambition of a prince. The same character was assumed, the same policy was adopted by the Italian, the Greek, or the Syrian, who ascended the chair of St. Peter, and after the loss of her legions and provinces, the genius and fortune of the popes again restored the supremacy of Rome. It is agreed that in the 8th century their dominion was founded on rebellion, and that the rebellion was produced and justified by the heresy of the iconoclasts. But the conduct of the 2nd and 3rd Gregory in this memorable contest is variously interpreted by the wishes of their friends and enemies. The Byzantine writers unanimously declare that, after a fruitless admonition, they pronounce the separation of the East and West and deprive the sacrilegious tyrant of the revenue and sovereignty of Italy. Their excommunication is still more clearly expressed by the Greeks, who beheld the accomplishment of the papal triumphs, and as they are more strongly attached to their religion than to their country, they praise instead of blaming the zeal and orthodoxy of these apostolical men. The modern champions of Rome are eager to accept the praise and the precedent. This great and glorious example of the deposition of royal heretics is celebrated by the cardinals Baronius and Bellarmine. And if they are asked why the same thunders were not hurled against the Neros and Julians of antiquity, they reply that the weakness of the primitive church was the sole cause of her patient loyalty. On this occasion, the effects of love and hatred are the same, and the zealous Protestants who seek to kindle the indignation and to alarm the fears of princes and magistrates expatiate on the insolence and treason of the two Gregories against their lawful sovereign. They are defended only by the moderate Catholics, for the most part, of the Gallican Church, who respect the saint without approving the sin. These common advocates of the crown and the mitre circumscribe the truth of facts by the rule of equity, scripture, and tradition, and appeal to the evidence of the Latins and the lives and epistles of the popes themselves. Two original epistles, from Gregory II to the Emperor Leo, are still extant, and if they cannot be praised as the most perfect models of eloquence and logic, they exhibit the portrait, or at least the mask, of the founder of the papal monarchy. "During 10 pure and fortunate years," says Gregory to the Emperor, "we have tasted the annual comfort of your royal letters, subscribed in purple ink, with your own hand, the sacred pledges of your attachment to the orthodox creed of our fathers. How deplorable is the change! How tremendous the scandal! You now accuse the Catholics of idolatry, and by the accusation you betray your own impiety and ignorance. To this ignorance we are compelled to adapt the grossness of our style and arguments. The first elements of holy letters are sufficient for your confusion. And were you to enter a grammar school and avow yourself the enemy of our worship, the simple and pious children would be provoked to cast their horn books at your head. After this decent salutation, the Pope attempts the usual distinction between the idols of antiquity and the Christian images. The former were the fanciful representations of phantoms or demons at a time when the true God had not manifested his person in any visible likeness. The latter are the genuine forms of Christ, his mother, and his saints, who had approved by a crowd of miracles the innocence and merit of this relative worship. He must indeed have trusted to the ignorance of Leo, since he could assert the perpetual use of images from the apostolic age and their venerable presence in the six synods of the Catholic Church. A more specious argument is drawn from present possession and recent practice. The harmony of the Christian world supersedes the demand of a general council, and Gregory, frankly, confesses that such assemblies can only be useful under the reign of an orthodox prince. To the impudent and inhuman Leo, more guilty than a heretic, he recommends peace, silence, and implicit obedience to his spiritual guides of Constantinople and Rome. The limits of civil and ecclesiastical powers are defined by the pontiff. To the former he appropriates the body, to the latter the soul. The sword of justice is in the hands of the magistrate. The more formidable weapon of excommunication is entrusted to the clergy. And in the exercise of their divine commission, a zealous son will not spare his offending father. The successor of Saint Peter may lawfully chastise the kings of the earth. You assault us, O tyrant, with a carnal and military hand. Unarmed and naked, we can only implore the Christ, the Prince of the heavenly host, that he will send unto you a devil for the destruction of your body and the salvation of your soul. You declare with foolish arrogance, I will dispatch my orders to Rome. I will break in pieces the image of Saint Peter, and Gregory, like his predecessor Martin, shall be transported in chains and in exile to the foot of the imperial throne. Would to God that I might be permitted to tread in the footsteps of the holy Martin. But may the fate of Constans serve as a warning to the persecutors of the church. After his just condemnation by the bishops of Sicily, the tyrant was cut off in the fullness of his sins by a domestic servant. The saint is still adored by the nations of Scythia, among whom he ended his banishment and his life. But it is our duty to live for the edification and support of the faithful people. Nor are we reduced to risk our safety on the event of a combat. Incapable as you are of defending your Roman subjects, the maritime situation of the city may perhaps expose it to your depredation. But we can remove to the distance of 24 stadia, to the first fortress of the Lombards, and then you may pursue the winds. Are you ignorant that the popes are the bond of union, the mediators of peace between the east and west? The eyes of the nations are fixed on our humility, and they revere as a god upon earth the apostle Saint Peter, whose image you threaten to destroy. The remote and interior kingdoms of the west present their homage to Christ and his vice-regent, and we now prepare to visit one of their most powerful monarchs, who desires to receive from our hands the sacrament of baptism. The barbarians have submitted to the yoke of the gospel, while you alone are deaf to the voice of the shepherd. These pious barbarians are kindled into rage. They thirst to avenge the persecution of the East. Abandon your rash and fatal enterprise. Reflect, tremble, and repent. If you persist, we are innocent of the blood that will be spilt in the contest. May it fall on your own head. The first assault of Leo against the images of Constantinople had been witnessed